Een speciale aflevering van je favoriete podcast vandaag, want Mike Mulder en ik hebben maar één gast. 15 seizoenen stond hij op de grid van de Formule 1. Eerst bij Williams, toen 9 jaar bij McLaren en uiteindelijk bij het toen gloednieuwe Red Bull Racing. 62 keer stond hij op het podium, waarvan 13 keer op de hoogste plek. Inmiddels doet onze Schotse gast ook dingen buiten de racerij. Zo is hij eigenaar van hotels en een tv-productiebedrijf. Wat die laatste twee nou met Formule 1 te maken hebben? Volgens hem een hele hoop. Daar gaat zijn nieuwe boek De Succesformule over, dat vanaf 29 oktober te koop is. Mijn naam is Rachid Finch. Dit is Formule 1 aan tafel met David Coulthard.
Formule 1 podcast. Formule 1 aan tafel.
En ja, de rest van ons gesprek is natuurlijk in het Engels. David Coulthard, welcome to our show and great to have you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So, you had an autobiography, It Is What It Is. Now you're out with another book, The Winning Formula, and you argue that F1 is a great school for business life. Why is that?
Well, this is something that I've obviously concluded upon reflection of my career rather than a preconceived idea going into being a professional racing driver. But if you look at sort of more traditional routes to a career, then that would involve, you know, finishing your schooling and maybe going to college or university. But what I've discovered through sport is that it gives you some great life learnings about trying your best, working in a team. It teaches you how to, you know, focus your mind on the future, not dwell on that moment, and certainly don't live in the past because there's no opportunity there.
Yeah. In hindsight, could have the younger David Coulthard have learned from the older Coulthard if he had read the book?
Yeah, I think I absolutely would have learned and benefited from being able to read this book because it would have saved me a lot of time and energy trying to gain the confidence in life to be comfortable not knowing everything. You know, I think there's a feeling when you're younger that you don't want to ask a question for fear of looking silly. So I think that in my case, I would have had a lot more confidence earlier in my career to challenge more intelligent people, to challenge those with university degrees. But just because they know how to design and build a racing car doesn't mean they actually know what the customer, in this case the driver, needs. Yeah.
I think in the book you talk a lot about being committed. It almost sounds as if that is maybe your secret weapon. It's all about work. Do you believe in such a thing like work-life balance?
Well, I think what works for me is I enjoy my work, and therefore I know it's very unusual, to have a career in sports and to be a sportsman. But you know, I retired from Formula One 11 years ago, but I'm still enjoying what I do. I'm still associated with the sport. And you know, I started a couple of businesses with partners that are in and around the industry. So I think that, work-life balance, of course, is always going to be more of an issue of family and being able to spend time with them. But, you know, the key element for me is that enjoying the work you do. And to be in an industry or to be in a job that you don't enjoy, I just don't see that as being sustainable.
If you look at your book and the things you learned as an F1 driver for 15 years, what would you say is the main lesson you've drawn from that time?
Well, you mentioned there about work ethic, but I think that a lot of people work hard and don't necessarily, find the opportunities in life to really grow within their career. So I think it's more than just having a work ethic. You certainly need to be able to stand out from your competition by putting in the long hours. I think people I've come across and a lot of younger people say, oh, I'm waiting for somebody to call me back. Well, maybe if you go to the place and ask for a meeting, or if you put yourself in an environment where you're more likely to bump into people that can help and influence your career. So making a different effort, because I see a lot of people that, maybe want to be in music or want to be in sport, but they don't want to start at the bottom. They want to go straight to the top. And I'm sorry, but I just haven't seen any of the great sports people start directly at the top. And I'm sure it's the same in business.
Is that for you the main reason why you took a step back from McLaren going on to Red Bull?
Well, that journey had reached its natural conclusion. I'd been 9 years at McLaren. And, it just felt like for the team and for myself that it was time for the next step. And in the case for McLaren, they went with Juan Pablo Montoya. and that relationship didn't develop. Of course, he spent a season or just over a season with the team. I went to Red Bull, and that was, you know, invigorating for me because it was a different challenge. It was a smaller team that had ideas and designs of being successful in the future. And I was able to use the experience that I gained through Williams and McLaren to really guide the people and to help the people within the team understand that it's not the name above the door that gives you success. It's the people within that company.
Yeah. From the outside world, it was looked upon as a step back, of course.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It was, in terms of the historical performance, that was the case. But if you're always looking at history, then all you're ever going to be doing is following the form book yes. that other people can apply. If you want to influence the future, then you're not looking back, you're looking forward. And in my case, I looked at the team, I looked at the people that were involved. I simply followed my gut instinct and worked with Christian Horner to bring Adrian Newey on board because I knew Adrian was a very influential designer. You know, that didn't happen by accident. It happened through hard work and application. So just to look at something and go, well, that's a step back, it won't work. Well, then you've already made your decision and you've already given up on the challenge.
Of course, in the Netherlands, we are very much focused on Red Bull Racing.
You're still with Red Bull, aren't you? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still part of the family. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
That is true. So we have a natural focus on Red Bull Racing due to Max Verstappen, of course. Do you think Red Bull can return to the sharp end of the grid, like rather than just winning a race here or there?
Well, I think that if we look at their journey over the last few years in the hybrid formula, I think that they've been able to maximize their opportunities on circuits where outright power has not been the main driving force for performance. You know, we all can acknowledge that Mercedes stole a march on the competition with some, great entry level to the hybrid formula. I think the gains that Ferrari have made over the last year show to Honda and show to Renault that developing that engine and power unit to make it better than it was is more than possible if you find the right people and the right investment in the right areas. So the answer to the question is, it lies in the relationship with Honda, and there's no question that the Red Bull team continually develop and deliver a good racing car. But without the right level of horsepower, you're just not going to beat Mercedes and Ferrari right now. So it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, the Max fans will want him to be a world champion because he's got the talent and deserves to be so. But, of course, right now, the best packages on the grid overall are either the Mercedes or the Ferrari. And the question, of course, is what does the future hold? Yeah. Are Honda going to develop and give him that opportunity next year and beyond? Or does he need to make a move to either Mercedes or Ferrari to get that opportunity? Mercedes, I would have thought, rests on what Hamilton does in the longer term, and definitely he's closer to the end of his career than the beginning. Yeah. And Ferrari, well, with Charles Leclerc there, then maybe they feel it's already volatile enough with Sebastian and him as two number ones trying to go head-to-head. It's not going to get any easier to manage if Max joins the team because he's a natural-born winner.
Your advice for Verstappen will be stay at Red Bull for the coming years.
If, you know, he has more access to information than I do, my advice would be to stay at Red Bull because I don't see room at the inn at Mercedes right now, and I don't see an easy route to make everything work within Ferrari. But of course, I think we all can accept that if Honda can continually develop and deliver a bit more power, then Red Bull will come into the mix and be able to take the fight. They won four Constructors' World Championships when the V8s were all very similar. So we know what they can do if they have an engine which is similar to Mercedes or Ferrari.
I'm sure, David, after being a racing driver for Red Bull Racing, you might have had the opportunity to maybe join Red Bull Racing in a management role, but you decided to start own businesses. Why did you make that choice rather than continuing in F1?
Well, I think I love the Jackie Stewart expression, which is to say you cannot be a little bit pregnant. You either are fully committed or you're not at all. Mm-hmm. So to go from being a fully committed racing driver to then going into a fully committed role within a team, then that's not something you can play at. That's something that you have to be based in the UK. You have to be living and breathing the team as I did as a driver. When I stopped in Formula One, it wasn't because I, lost the love of competition, but I had been 15 seasons at that level. I'd been testing before that, and I didn't have the mental commitment to continue in that position. So the step away was to, continue within the sport as an ambassador with Red Bull and working with them to work in television, which obviously involves going to the Grand Prix, but you don't have to be in the television studios during the week. So it allowed me time to sort of reevaluate who I am, what I would like to do in the future. And bearing in mind, I have a wife and a 10-year-old son who are based in Monte Carlo. If I was full-time with a racing team, then you've got to relocate. And I wasn't sure that was the thing I wanted to do at that time.
Is commitment something that can compensate for maybe a lower level of talent?
I truly believe that I've achieved a greater level of success within Formula One than the talent that I had. I think that, I had obviously a base level of talent that was enabled me to progress through the various formulas. But, quite clearly, I was not as good as a Max or a Lewis or, Michael or any of these other exceptional drivers. But I think that I was able to go further than maybe others with the same talent as me because I turned up. I cared. I was, at the factory. I spent time with the mechanics, the engineers. I put time into the sponsors, the partners, the media. I tried to do the best that I could within the limitations that I had.
So is that something you now say upon reflection, that maybe people like Michael, perhaps Mika Häkkinen as well, were faster than you, or is that some, or more talented than you, as you put it? Or is that something you also knew as a racing driver? Because we, as viewers, always feel that drivers always think they're the best of the grid.
Yeah, I think you have to believe that you have the potential to be the best. I can look back on my career and recognize more of my limitations than when I was in my career, because you're so immersed in the moment that it's quite difficult to step back and look at things. We have this expression that you cannot see the wood for the trees because you're so in the moment. So I think a basic essential ingredient of any sports person is absolute belief, the belief that they have the ability and they have the talent. But on reflection, of course, I know that I wasn't as fast as Mika or Michael or various other drivers, but I earned my place in Formula One through the journey that I took. And I think I stayed, with the teams I drove for so long because it was recognized that I was an asset to the team and that I worked hard and I played my role.
At the moment, they're discussing the new plans, for new regulations for 2021. I mean, and it seems that everybody has their own opinion about it. Do you think it has become too much of a democracy than back in your days?
I saw in Scotland recently a law was passed that meant that parents were not allowed to smack their children, which, we have a 10-year-old. I smacked his hand once when he was really misbehaving. But I remember growing up, I got smacked quite often. And I love my parents, and I don't resent the fact that they smacked me. So that was then. And today is a different time, and the world just keeps changing, and you have to live for that time. So the premise of life, I think, is that the moment you give people choice, then there will be difference of opinion. If you look at what's going on in the UK with Brexit, this is all because of difference of opinion. If you look at politics, it's difference of opinion. If you look at religion, it's difference of opinion. My religious figure is better than your religious figure, and then we have wars. So of course in a business like Formula One, where there's a lot of money involved and people are trying to protect their competitive advantage, or they're trying to gain a competitive advantage, you're going to get difference of opinion. So the complexity is the fact that we are a technology sport. In football, it's a much more simple set of rules. But I see today people are still debating whether the VAR system is the right way or the wrong way. To me, logically, taking the pressure off the referee and relying on video replay, where it has to be more factually accurate than one person's eye, has to be the way to go forward. But that, I'm not a football fan, so therefore it's easy for me to say that. If you're a football fan, then I'm sure there's many reasons why my view is the wrong view. So that's where we have the problem, asking people their opinion.
So in this world, we now have David Coulthard, the businessman. What is it you would look for in a business partner or perhaps an employee?
Well, understanding of that particular industry. So as I mentioned earlier, I didn't know how to design and build a racing car, but clearly I needed people on the team that knew how to design and build a racing car. So in looking for my partners, I'm looking for people that have the skills, but also have the openness and the, let's say, the sporting integrity, which means in sport, we don't have a blame culture, we have a responsibility culture. I talk about this in the book, where you can say to someone that actually all of that is good, but let's not talk about the good, let's focus on the bad. You're not handling very well this situation, or you're not being as open and straightforward or transparent. And being honest with somebody and being openly critical is very difficult in modern society, because people are struggling with that, quite honestly, to take criticism. And actually, out of criticism comes your biggest source of potential growth. So in sport, the football manager, when he's shouting at the players, he isn't standing shouting, "Great, wonderful, you're amazing." He's standing there going, "Come forward, pass the ball. You know, don't do that, do this." Mm-hmm. If you actually look at what sport does, it's constantly giving direction, or it's questioning. If you listen to Lewis Hamilton at the most recent Grand Prix, he's saying to his team, "Are you sure this is the right strategy?" He's not saying, "Hey guys, thanks for this great strategy," well, during the race. He waits until after the race to make that judgment. So, you know, having the right partners and the right people to work with who can handle constructive criticism is a key for me in being able to have growth in a business.
You mentioned Lewis Hamilton. I mean, isn't it astounding what he's achieving at the moment?
Yeah, I think, well, he's going to get the title again this year unless something remarkable happens.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, Michael's record was incredible, and he was a winning machine.
Yeah.
And from my point of view, it's quite convenient to be able to reflect that I was, you know, racing at a time against the most successful driver in the history of the sport. That gives me some comfort when I was finishing second in the Drivers' Championship. Yeah. But in the end, all of these records, everything is there for the next generation to improve on. We want more for our children. We want the next generation to be better than us. Otherwise, where's the evolution? I don't believe any parent or anyone that really cares for their family wants their family to fail. They want them to be best at what they do. They want them to be better. And therefore, as humans continue to evolve and society evolves, there should be more opportunity.
We've got one final question for you, if you don't mind. We had the great opportunity to give two copies of your book to our listeners. Would you be kind enough to give them a question so that they can answer that and win one of your copies?
Okay, well, the question I would pose to your listeners is, how many pole positions did I have during my Formula One career?
All right, so how many poles did David Coulthard have in his F1 career? We know that there were 13 wins, but how many poles?
Thank you very much, David. And maybe we'll speak again sometime soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thank you, David.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Ja, als je het antwoord weet op die vraag, hoeveel pole positions had David Coulthard in de Formule 1, dan is het boek De Succesformule wellicht voor jou, dat vanaf 29 oktober te verkrijgen is in de boekhandel. Weet je het antwoord? Stuur dan een e-mail naar podcast@grandprixradio.nl. Ik dacht eigenlijk, Mike, dat we het vooral over Formule 1 zouden hebben, maar we hebben veel meer geleerd eigenlijk.
Ik vind David Coulthard, buiten dat het een prima coureur was en 9 jaar bij McLaren heeft gezeten, volgens mij is hij degene die het langst bij McLaren heeft gereden. 9 jaar lang.
Ja,
hij is natuurlijk een verschrikkelijk succesvol zakenman ook geworden nadien. En alle respect. Ja.
Absoluut. Het was een bijzondere aflevering van deze podcast. Dit was Formule 1 aan tafel voor deze keer. Volgende keer zijn we ongetwijfeld weer terug met een tafel vol meningen. Ben je nog niet geabonneerd op onze podcast? Regel dat dan eventjes in je favoriete podcast-app. En hou GrandPrixRadio.nl in de gaten voor het laatste nieuws uit de Formule 1. Graag tot de volgende keer.
De Formule 1 podcast. Formule 1 aan tafel.